all that matters is... Wrong!
This town deserves a better class.
Heavy Metal Podcast.
I'm gonna get a...
If you do not listen, then the hell with you.
Walk through the gate of consciousness. Stop, love, drop from under you.
Yas Queen. I don't know. I thought I'd kick off the new episodes with an appeal to the youth. Let them know I'm hip to be square. I'm down with the lingo ringo. I speak your TikTok talk from 30 years ago. And if you needed any further evidence that I am fingering the pulse of the young people today, I am talking about a heavy metal band from the 70s with two other 40-something-year-old white guys from North America. Sorry, olds. We're immune to your consolations. We're quite aware of what we're going through. It's mostly back pain and some severe to moderate memory loss. What was I talking about? Ah, yes. What else but the parental nightmare of the 70s, the single greatest threat to the youth of the Western world, and the family snack cabinet, Black Sabbath. We talked about Sabbath's legacy as the progenitors of heavy metal in episode 1 of And Volume for All, but I wanted to go back and do a deep dive. Ooh, that's a good name for a network. A podcast network. Thank you guys for having me. I'm so excited. Go check out all of the incredible shows on the Deep Dive podcast network. I just got to join. My decoder ring comes any minute. I wanted to go back and do a deep dive into the band, their discography, and the impact they have had and continue to have on the genre that they created. I got to sit down recently with two of my musical brothers. One of whom is Britt Hume. That's right, from Fox News. He's the giant Easter Island head with a tie. That's my Britt Hume impression. I know, I'm the rich little of this closet. I got to sit down recently with two of my musical brothers, one of whom is my actual brother, and both of whom are named Rye, more or less. First up is the OG slinger of Sabbath here on the old Pod Talkies, the man behind the mic at Sabbath Bloody Podcast, your cool older brother from America's pale little sister to the north. The guy who always brings the smooth Canadian rye to the party. You know him and fear him by one name and one name alone. Just like Oprah. That man is the one, the only, Rye. But then there's another one. This Rye, known more widely as Ryan, is my brother from the same mother, and the single greatest reason why I have any taste in music whatsoever. Had it not been for Ryan, I would have probably been the dude who says, "Oh, you like metal? Yeah, Foo Fighters are cool." But instead, this mother puncher, who has never actually punched our mother, or anyone's mother, for all I know, single-handedly dragged me back to heavy metal over and over throughout the years until I realized that there might be something more brutal than Father John Misty. I actually don't know a single song by Father John Misty. It's just a silly name for a very serious person. Ryan is both the man who gave me the title of this podcast, And Volume for All, in case you thought you were listening to We Can Do Hard Things, as well as my musical barometer, bellwether, conscience, and milkman, just for variety. He's my idol, my hero, my best friend, and my brother, Ryan. Now, for those of you familiar with Sabbath Bloody Podcast, you'll recognize Rye's dulcet tones, and of course, listeners of And Volume for All are all well acquainted with my Ed Norton having just done a speedball quality, but the one guy you hear with the radio voice, the only guy who sounds like he really should have a podcast, that's the guy without a podcast. My brudda. So, to jump right in, Rye and I began our discussion of Black Sabbath, their history, their discography, their place in the larger canon of heavy metal, where one might expect that we would begin, by ragging on death metal.
I want to appreciate death metal and black metal, but fuck, it's hard. Because I hate death metal. I fucking hate it. And I really try to like, and every occasionally, like that Venom Prison album that I really loved, I was like, oh my God, this is great. I love this. The vocals finally work for me. And then I found out it's a woman. I was like, oh, well, no wonder.
It makes sense.
It doesn't sound like all of the other, like, you know, the Cookie the Monster guttural, vomiting up his liver shit.
I do find that. Yeah. Like a lot of the, when it's run through a filter of like, a different language or something. Sometimes it works a little better.
It does.
Even like Sepultura. I love Sepultura.
Yep.
And it's like, you know, that's about as death as I go. But like vocal wise, like that barky guttural stuff. But
right.
Just because they're content. Kind of English as a second language. It's like.
It's also, you know, I struggle with, you know, everyone posts those big, you know, the most brutal, gruesome album covers with there's blood and hatchets and everything as a looks like flesh has been stripped off.
Right.
I'm not interested in that.
No.
Gojira sings about wormholes and flying whales, and Sepultura sings about, you know, political struggles. And I mean, the content of that kind of death metal is so much more interesting to me because it's deeper. It's more, I don't know. It's just like something I want to think about, something I want to dwell on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it warrants the like extreme, you know?
Eventually, history reasserted itself and the French surrendered, so we finally got around to the topic at hand.
You're both Sabbath fanatics. You both love Black Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either all of it or some of it or whatever, but I'd be interested to hear, like, how you guys came to it. Were you like, fuck, paranoid, converted? Because for me, it was like tipping over the vending machine. I kind of had to rock it back and forth a couple of times where I was like, damn, go listen to some indie hip hop. And then it came back and I was like, all right, okay, no, that's pretty cool. And then at some point in grad school, I got high and decided to listen to my old music. And I was like, oh, fuck, it's a stoner band. I have no idea.
Right. You know,
in like my mid-20s. So anyway, I'm just kind of interested in how you got to it. Rye, if you want to start them.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, they are a classic rock band as well. So my dad had a lot of the album, or he had a couple of the albums. But I remember Paranoid as a kid. Mm-hmm. I remember, like, fucking around with it and looking at it. And I remember he had the swirl because he had an old, like, Irish pressing. And he threw it on for me for sure, because I remember like listening to War Pigs with him and it being like, whoa, you know, like as a kid, it wasn't like it became my band then or anything. But
right.
With my dad's classic rock, he had some cool stuff in his record collection. I didn't really like the folk stuff he had until like later on, like in a lot of folk, but he had like a lot of classic rock in there, lots of Thin Lizzy. And I kind of lumped them in to that zone, and they didn't like scare me as much, but they obviously felt heavier
on the darker side. Yeah,
I remember specifically like Electric Funeral sounding like twisted and weird to me, like that's coming from some evil place.
Right.
Bye.
Most children of the 90s, or people who were coming to age in the 90s, Columbia House.
Yep.
So through there, after I bought all the Busta Rhymes that was in the catalog there and all my old school hip hop, I moved towards some heavier stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was thinking about this recently, but 90s movie soundtracks.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about like scores. I'm talking about like the...
Like singles.
Written for, yeah. Yeah. Like singles, exactly. Yep. So that's one of them. Like, I started eating up those, and there was a lot on Columbia House, I think, just because they're linked to Sony or whatever. And I was able to get bands that they didn't have the full cassette of them there, but I could, like, you know, check out bands through that. So, like, yeah, singles was a big one for sure. What's the Soundgarden one is on there, the killer Soundgarden song.
I don't remember.
Like, I mean, Woods on it. Birth Ritual. That's what it is.
Birth Ritual. That's right. That's
fucking
right.
Killer song. So I love that even back then.
Is Last Action Hero. Last Action Hero had a killer fucking soundtrack. Yeah. I bought it because I was a giant AC/DC fan at the time, and I wanted to hear Big Gun because that was like their new song or whatever. And then that's what made me love Alice in Chains.
One of the best Brian Johnson songs too. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It is. And totally unique from all the others.
Yeah. They're known for that. They really push the boundaries.
So much variety.
Yeah.
Is this Brian Johnson?
Real genre bending on that.
Yeah. It was like post metal, man. It was fucking. I think about it like even like Beavis and Butthead, as stupid as it sounds, that like who was showing me music was a couple of Nimrod fucking cartoon guys.
Right.
Like if I say that to like my daughter in the future, right? How did you find all the music that you liked back then? Well, there was this cartoon with these two idiots. Anything they said was cool. I thought was cool.
There are whole artists whose entire career can be traced back to Beavis and Butthead liking them.
Whoa. Hey, Beavis.
Yeah. Check it out. Are these guys from Seattle?
No, ass munch. They're American.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like Rob Zombie would be working at a fucking Dunkin' Donuts right now if Beavis and Butthead hadn't loved Thunderkiss. They were every single time that would come on, people went crazy for it. And suddenly all these metalheads were like, well, shit, man, I guess White Zombie's cool now.
For sure.
That's how we have, you know, dig through the ditches.
Which I'm grateful for. I love fucking Zombie, man. I'm all about that. I mean, this isn't about Sabbath. Yeah, I'm talking about metal.
No. That's kind of how it happened for me too, though, is that like there were a couple of bands that brought me back into metal. And one of them was like, Ryan, you had played System of a Down for me after I was kind of out of metal. And I was like, fuck, this is great. This is really cool because it allowed, for some reason, like what they're doing allowed me not to take it so seriously. You know what I mean? Right. When they would do like the heavy growl thing and then they'd go into, you know, you go, this is silly, but that's kind of awesome. And
yet you really don't like silly metal.
No.
I don't like fun.
Yeah, you don't like
fun. He doesn't like fun. He's no fun zone. Yeah.
I'm not a fun person. I don't want to listen to music for fun, but I did like that. And Marilyn Manson was another one that was like, got me into it. And the most recent one was Mastodon, and Mastodon was what kind of got me back fully into metal. And then it was like going back and digging through all of the influences and where it's all coming from and stuff got me back into Sabbath sort of as a lifestyle.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So the Sabbath connection that I was drawing towards with the Columbia House thing would be through there. I got the Nativity in Black thing. So that's basically like a hybrid of like, it's yep. And like, you know, I was all about these comps, cause I kind of came from like the tape cassette thing was my jam. So I'd like, my friends would have CDs or whatever. I'd go and I'd like steal the tracks I liked. And so I go for these comps, but when I got that one, it took me to a different level of like appreciating how much they can maintain, like to see like this next generation, this heavier music that I was just kind of getting into and still seemed kind of the influence there. Brought me back to them. And then that's when I, you know, just went full on.
Los Angeles, 1969. They shot, stabbed, and bludgeoned 9 people to death. Committed one of the most heinous crimes in history.
With metal, like you, I've kind of dipped in and out. There's like blind spots all over the place. Sabbath like held, because once I got into the Aussie era stuff and I did the full burn through that stuff, it all worked for me. But I never touched the Dio stuff. I never touched the Martin stuff until I did the podcast here. So that was kind of the point of it, because I constantly kind of write off the Dio stuff as being lumped in with the metal that I wasn't really into, which was that.
Yeah.
Traditional, that power kind of Euro style, like
kind of the new album stuff a little
bit. But like to me it was like I had friends that were like way into like Blind Guardian and Iced Earth and stuff like that, and I was like, yeah, it's a little too D&D for me, like I love
I knew that was coming.
I love aspects of it, but
that's
like
exactly what it is. Ryan, how about you? I know a little bit about your journey, but I'm younger than you, so you went off to college and you weren't at the house anymore, so I didn't really know what you're listening to, but.
Well, actually, I think I have you primarily to thank for it. When I went off to college, I mean, obviously when we were growing up, Quinn and I would listen to, you know, the local rock radio stations, and Ozzy was always on.
101 KUFO.
KGON.
KGON.
Portland's classic rock. We loved Ozzy, you know. Ozzy was great. And what they would do, they would always play like a three-song block, and they would always include an Ozzy song and a Sabbath song and another Ozzy song. Right. And in my mind, it was just sort of like, okay, well, Ozzy is just all of these songs. I didn't really think about Black Sabbath. But I had Paranoid. I bought Paranoid because I loved it. I thought it was amazing. And that was really as far as my depths go, because that was all they ever played on the radio.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, go off to college and, you know, it's a wonderful eye-opening experience, yada, yada, yada. I got way into metal. My taste got heavier. They got harder. And I started, you know, really getting into, there was a period of time where I was hugely into Corrosion of Conformity.
Oh, yeah. Right. They're a big one for me.
Not that they're like super heavy metal or anything like that, but that was a big band for me.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
They also kind of bridged that gap between sort of like, they could kind of be alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. They could like stand with the guys with the flannel, but you knew that they were like, they're just degenerate stoners underneath everything else.
Yeah. He still got the Vitus, armbands on and
stuff.
Exactly. So it's funny when Rye was talking about the Nativity in Black album.
Mm-hmm.
That
huge.
When I heard Lord of This World, the cover.
Yeah, come on now.
He goes, holy shit. Neglected my roots. I gotta go back. If all of these bands that I love, you got Megadeth, you got Pantera, you've got, Pantera wasn't on that one, but
they were on the second one.
The second one.
That's right. They were on the second one. All these bands that I was really into were doing covers of Sabbath songs. I fucked up. I needed to correct that, right? Like I had to go back. And at the time, I remember, Quinn, you were listening to a ton of Sabbath. I think you had just purchased Volume 4 and you were talking about how great Volume 4 was. And I was like,
One day I'm going to take its title and amalgamate it with that Metallica album you like. And
totally. Ryan's the one that came up with it, actually. Ryan's the one who gave me the title of the podcast.
Don't blame me for that.
No, he did.
That's the only thing that got me on here. Like, I don't really do guest spots, but I'm like, there's two good albums combined. Yeah, I'll do it.
But that was it, man. That was my my bridge. And then I think the first thing I did is I bought Volume 4 and Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath at the same time. And I immediately got on my bike and I rode down to Cellophane Square the next day. And I was like, give me fucking everything. And I just bought every Sabbath record that they had. And for one reason or another, they didn't have Never Say Die and Technical Ecstasy. So for the longest time, I didn't even know that those
records hot sellers.
Yeah, right. That's right. They were just sold out. That's it.
It was a used CD store. So you go down, you spend like $3 on a CD that somebody's had for 30 years. Right. Or, well, I guess at the time CDs had only been out for 10.
Yeah. Right.
But it was, you know, it was cheap and like nobody had those albums. Nobody bought them. So there was no used copies and it was kind of before you could hop onto Google and
right,
what's the entire Black Sabbath discography?
Yeah.
And so for years, I didn't even know those existed. And then I think I left college, found out that they were, I was like, oh shit, I got to go buy these. And the very first thing I heard, you know, was Johnny Blade's weird keyboard instrumentation. And I was like, oh fuck, no, I can't do this.
Right.
You know, everything up until that point had suckered me in. And since, obviously, the story, moral of the story is I now fully love and embrace Never Say Die. That I think that was really it for me, was recognizing that the roots were there, that I had neglected it. I'd identified myself as a metalhead. I felt like I was missing a really important part of the story. And I wanted to fix that. And when I dove back in to fix it, it wouldn't let me go. Sabbath just became everything. And because you could see its fingerprint on every single band that came afterwards.
Perfect. That's that's like the perfect segue. I wish I was on a segue when you said that. I agree. There's a staying power and there's like something that it just continues. I keep finding new stuff.
Yeah.
Tuned down and Geezer followed him tuning down, but that doesn't really happen until Master. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking about like, well, you know, you can't credit that as sort of like, oh, well, they took it a step and a half down to create, you know, metal.
That's usually how everybody tells that story, but
right.
But
right.
I agree. That's not the truth.
It's a, No.
Yeah. And I think they were doing it live probably too. It would just be like those first two albums were done so quickly. And so they probably were like, oh, we got to stay in tune, man. We got to just tune every 5 seconds and then absolutely. Go.
Yeah.
But live, they would always sling down a little bit even before master. So,
and that's, I'm sure they would, but I was trying to figure out like, what is the sort of, when we talk about like the birth of heavy metal, you know, like that album Sabbath is, I talked a little bit about it on the first episode about, you know, it's definitely the aesthetic and it's the philosophy. It's that darkness. It's the heavier sound, but it still sounds bluesy and jazzy. But then I was like, you know, I was really listening to Geezer and what Geezer was doing. And because Geezer didn't know he was a rhythm guitarist and he didn't know really what to do with the bass, listening to him and figuring out, you know, that him deciding to play exactly on the riff, like precisely on the riff, making that riff sound so heavy. And then also filling in around Iommi, where all of a sudden you go, and you go, whoa, where did, you know, he was like the first bassist I heard, because every other bassist was just supporting or helping out the lead. And I'd never really heard the bass. And then it was like, oh, there it is. There's the bass. And I've been more and more thinking about Geezer as part of the innovation of heavy metal. And like we all say, Iommi's the god. Iommi started it all. He downtuned. And then all of a sudden, you know, Pantera came out of his butt. I think there are other aspects of that. Where does it start? Where does that heavy metal thing start? You know, and the blues and jazz end, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a big thing. And I don't know if this is like a weird way of doing it, but I was thinking about this. I really have to separate like heavy from metal.
I get that.
So like to say they're like the godfathers of heavy metal, there's like two kind of strains of influence there.
Totally.
And it's really easy to do it that way, just heavy and metal. So like the heavy would be kind of what you're talking about, the way that like Geezer's in there and like the bass and drums are kind of moving forward in the mix. And there's like these abrupt, but like extremely satisfying, like tempo changes. You know, that's something that's crazy with them, those ramp ups at the end. It's, you wouldn't think to switch that way, but like it works, you know.
Do you mean like on the first album, do you mean like the end of the title track, like
the end of the title track? That's one for sure, because you're in this dirge at the beginning and then like they ramp it up at the end.
Totally.
It's just, it creates the, it brings the whole thing together, you know. Same with, and they continue to do that through like War Pigs does that.
Yep.
That's kind of one of their signatures.
I think a big part of that is the display of virtuosity, right? Tony is obsessed with demonstrating that his fingers work just fine and he can play all of the really great riffs. And so you hear those really interesting classical guitar sections and you hear these really intricate and complicated. And I think those displays of virtuosity become a staple. I mean, listen to anything Metallica has done, right? There's always got to be a section where they play this really intricate opening that doesn't, it's not heavy, it's not fast, but it's complex. You know, Sepultura, same thing. Pick any band that is a heavy metal band. There's it's almost like it's a...
Yeah, it's like a trope.
Yeah, it's just a common metal trope. And I think that comes directly from that early album of Iommi just showing off, just playing fast and complicated.
Yeah, and recognizing that kind of classical vibe that's in, like he's always talked about that, like he loves that dark and light, and that's why those things exist, like the embryo is there before the children of the grave, because it's like that next thing will hit harder, and like that's the innovation of like heavy beyond what other bands were doing, and that's something that's timeless about Sabbath. I think they're the innovators of that kind of dynamic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. To that extent. I mean, I know jazz is all over the place and like it does these bursts, and like classical music in general is like has the ebbs and flows like that, but the way they brought it into a four piece and made it work like that.
And there is, it's funny because you can hear it just listening to the first album through that filter of where's the jazz, where are the blues, is hearing them handing sections of the track off to one another so much more than they do after that. They do a little bit in Paranoid, but really then they start playing together a lot more. But it is that, you know, okay, here comes Bill's, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then we're going to go into Geezer's bass, and then we're going to go into the song, and now we'll all come together into this. And even the way they structure like a Behind the Wall of Sleep, where it's like riff, vocal riff, guitar riff, vocal riff, and that stuff where they're handing it off. Blues and jazz in, you know, in real time into metal, that it's becoming. But I think it's interesting you say like the difference between like heavy and metal, because Ryan, you've said it to me before about the difference between like doom metal and doom. And I'm sure Ryan will have, I know we're all doom guys. We all have our own proclivities, but we're all doom people. Because I've never asked you about it, because I was like, I'm going to wait until we're recording to ask him about that.
Are you asking me about the difference between doom and doom metal right now?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, shit, man. I'm on the spot. I'm going to answer this weird. I'm going to forget how words work.
Good.
It's such a great with doom, it's such a great word. It invokes so much feeling in itself, even more so than metal, because metal was kind of like a slag, you know, like that was like critics slagging them. And so I view metal kind of the same way as punk. So it's like, it takes the band to like embrace that title for it to become like a metal band.
Right.
Whereas doom kind of just like naturally spawns out of their fucking evil hippie shit that like Geezer's doing. And
that's okay. Thank you.
It's like, you know, yeah.
Just let Rye answer this question. I don't think I can do it.
No. That's the thing.
Sorry,
that I
Doom
to get
gets
to
me excited.
Like, if that is somehow articulable, it's so perfect to not be able to articulate the word articulate. but like how in terms of Sabbath, like the difference between doom metal and doom.
Yeah, I think doom is something that takes both the aesthetic and the tone of the original Sabbath recordings and sort of takes in stride the idea of blues and jazz being sort of incorporated into it. I think also lo-fi recording technology, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to get a really clean sound on an analog setup. Mm-hmm. That to me speaks of doom. That says, hey, we're trying to bring what Sabbath brought to the table in terms of our tone, in terms of our sound, in terms of our vibe. And I think when you get to doom metal, the pacing stays the same, but we've said we want to now incorporate something even heavier. We want to keep it nice and slow. Low and slow has always been the name of the game when it comes to that. But now we want to add an element of more modernity to it, whether that's harsh vocals, it's the heaviness of the riffage. Production, take Witchcraft for instance, those first couple albums, I don't think you hardly hear any distortion at all on it, right?
It's
more, and yet you can tell when you listen to Witchcraft, that's Sabbath.
You gotta get somewhere, you know you cannot stay, and that's
directly out of Black Sabbath's playbook. And it's wonderful. It's this really, you know, interesting and complex experience that they're pulling all of those sounds out and making something really new out of it, and yet still cleaving to tradition in the past.
Yeah.
Doom metal for me feels more like we're going to take it the next step. We're going to move that into the future.
Got it.
So I think that's the way that my brain operates it, but it doesn't necessarily.
No, totally. Just what Rye was saying about heavy and metal and doom metal. Just, it made me think about that and like where, you know, because there is that. If you listen to somebody today who's just like, that band's trying to do Sabbath, which is fine. A lot of them are, you know, they're trying to sort of channel their own impulses through, you know, the amps that Sabbath had, which is like, okay, cool. But then there is that, yeah, that contingent that's sort of like taking it in another direction or taking it. So that makes sense to me. But I want to get to before I get too bogged down and just us jamming and talking about stuff. I know, Rye, you're a late convert to Dio, as was I. Ryan sat me down actually in that room that he's sitting in right there and was like, okay, you got to hear this, and played Computer God for me years ago. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's a great song. I don't want to listen to the rest of it, but that's a great song. I really like that. And then now, you know, cut to now, and Dehumanizers is like one of my favorite Sabbath albums. Like, and Dio became part of my like Sabbath canon. So who is for you guys Sabbath canon? Are you only Ozzy Dio, or is Martin included? And does Vinny, is it Apice? Is it, it's Italian, right? Vinny Apice? Apice? Vinny?
Yeah, him and his brother pronounce it differently. So like, don't even.
Oh, of course they do.
Wait.
Just to fuck with us.
He and his brother pronounce it differently?
Yeah. There's a whole thing. There's
really?
Yeah, I think one's more linked to their Italian ancestry or something.
I see.
Or more into it. So the other one, Vinny's pretty chill and American.
I see.
Americanized.
But he does it with his hands.
He does.
Vinny a piece. He has to.
I'll start this one off. Yeah, I think the cop out answer is probably the first thing that springs to mind. Black Sabbath is whatever Tony Iommi says Black Sabbath is. Right. If you're putting the Black Sabbath label on an album, that's Black Sabbath. But I'm not going to listen to a Martin album, and I'm not going to listen to, you know, I love Dio. I love Ozzy. I was later to the Dio game. But I've come to love all of his stuff, and even a you know, appreciation for all of Dio's solo work as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have such a hard time believing that when we get to like Born Again, that Iommi is having any fun at all. It doesn't sound to me like that album or any of the things that came after it were really in keeping with the spirit and the tone of Sabbath. There was still some, you know, like you put spooky stuff on the album covers and you put a, you know, headless cross and then, you know, whatever.
Right.
And so, yeah, you've got all the trappings. You've got something that's dressed up to look like a Sabbath record. But when you turn it on, it just sounded like 80s butt rock to me. And it felt so out of character with everything that I had come to expect. And if you love 80s butt rock, man, those albums are for you. There's like six guys on Twitter that are keeping, you know, Born Again alive. You can probably name them.
Rye's one of them.
I'm one of them. Because for me, it's like the first 11, including Born Again, are kind of like, that's an interesting arc to me. And that's like a zone where I can always, and this is coming from a guy who did like a run through of the entire catalog too, as pretty fresh, like, you know, 4 years ago, and like set kind of my,
yeah,
like you said at the beginning there, like if Black Label is, or Black Label, if Black Sabbath is on the cover, it's Black Sabbath.
Black Sabbath album.
Yeah. If Black Label's on the cover, you're going to get a lot of pig squeals.
Still getting a pretty Sabbathy vibe. Just,
just so that you know, Rye, this isn't actually a podcast. It's an intervention about Born Again.
Been meaning to talk.
No. Okay.
No, I listened to, you know what though? Honestly, what you say, what you just said about the arc of it.
Yeah.
I think that's the first time it's clicked in my head where I go, okay,
I get that because I listened to the album today. I listened to Mob Rules and then to Born Again. I mean, we're ending with Falling Off the Edge of the World and Over, and it's like huge, enormous. And then first song is trashed. And I'm like, this sounds different. This just sounds like something else. But there's something about how compact that album is and how deliberate it feels. I mean, there's stuff that I just, Zero the Hero and Digital Bitch, I just was like, I fucking hate this so much. But it's got its own thing.
Yeah. And there's like if you think about genres, but think about like literary shit. So think about fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. It's so like, it's just them going and having this time.
Got it.
And just all this fuckery going on. They're pulling stuff. It's all getting onto tape. It's not getting edited. And then the tour is so fucking crazy. And like, they're right. all like, it just has this like manicness around it. And there's certain songs that are just really solid in there. Like, you can tell the songs, but they're just like, the production's absolute garbage.
Right.
You know, it'd be easy to close it off at Dio and be like, what a fucking amazing band. But it's kind of nice to embrace some of the fuckery, but you know, just do one album of it.
We don't need to get to Forbidden.
Maybe once in a while, like I'll play Eternal Idol. There's a couple of tracks from there. This title track in particular is doomy as fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. And like Cross Purposes has some like 90s vibes that I dig. I know they're just copping, like, you know, there's snakes eating his own tail and they're basically copying Alice in Chains and stuff. But I still like that because it's right in my wheelhouse of like what turned me on to metal in the beginning. So like that kind of works for me. The 80s stuff is just a complete blind spot for me in general. So like, letting Dio in was a big thing for me. And when you look at how amazing that Dio stuff is, like, that was a big thing for you, then you're hopeless if you're trying to like let in fucking Seven Star or something, right?
I love you describe it like let it in.
Right, you just blew my mind with something that you just said.
What's that?
The Cross Purposes record, the snake eating its own tail.
Yeah.
Black Sabbath is now aping Alice in Chains. I had never thought of it.
Oh no.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that 90s Martin stuff that I see a lot of that. Reach out and take for me fruit of the poison tree. Give me your body and your soul. My youth is fading fast. Years melt into the this mortal life will take its toll. I'm sick and tired of losing. You find this so amusing. It's all I have to keep myself in this state. I often find myself, some of the riffs will come in, I'll be like, oh, that's cool. It kind of sounds like Cathedral or like Candlemass or something. And then I'm like, but it's like not nearly as good. Like, right. I should be listening to Candlemass. And then I'm like, wait a minute. Doesn't Cathedral sound like Bad Sabbath? Like,
yeah. You know, you get Sabbath that does all this shit. They inspire thousands, literally thousands of bands. Those bands put out music. It suddenly becomes huge in the moment. And then Sabbath goes, hey, let's take some inspiration. I mean, that's this weird Ouroboros.
Yeah. And it's pure too. Like, cause it happened. If we go back to like my whole heavy separation with metal, by the time they get into the Dio era, they're really pushing the metal stuff. And like,
right.
You know, they're flying the flag as much as like Priest, of course. And like, they're in with those guys as like the beginning of like the mainstream metal. They're an influence as much as they are influenced. It's not like they're like jumping onto a bandwagon.
Right.
And even when they get into that kind of, like I say, the 90s Martin stuff in particular, I know he was like palling with like the Swedish, like that, I guess it would have been probably like a second wave of of doom metal by that point. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just Tony Martin just like sees that he's playing in there and just like goes blockbuster with it. And like mm-hmm. you know, dollar store doom is what he kind of screams to me, like amazing, talented guy. I know everybody will defend and saying like, oh, Martin's just like the most technically best of all of them. He can do Dio, he can do Ozzy, and he can do it all well. It's like, yeah, sure. But
I don't want to listen.
What
to
is
it.
This? Like, yeah. Yeah. He's a utility guy, and the way he's treated too. I mean, stand up guy, great guy and everything. Yeah. Definitely delivers when he needs to, but doesn't have that special flavor. Mm-mm. And I at least feel like in Born Again, they're not like Ian Gillan coming in from fucking the pedigree that he is with the purple and stuff like that. They're not going to boss him around. So he does his own thing right. in it, and it just works because it's just some fucking chaos. And Glenn Hughes could have probably done the same thing if he wasn't so fucked up at that time where he just couldn't follow
through. Or all of them at that point. I mean,
right. Yeah, they were on a different tip there too. Like,
it just felt like, for me, at some point, the thread got lost. What was the original sort of the foundational elements of the band? What was the foundational idea? What did we build on? What did we create mm-hmm. together? And then it felt to me at some point, there's this really sharp drop off where they just felt rudderless. There was no
that direction. Would be the departure of Geezer Butler.
Yep, absolutely.
Big time. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a huge part of it.
Because like and Bill, of course, too, when he starts. Yeah. But at least like the Dio stuff has enough momentum that it carries itself through, and Vinny's awesome. Right. I love Mob Rules. I like that more than Heaven.
Great.
Now.
Yeah, and great.
Humanizer, I like that more than Mob Rules. So they only get better with their.
I don't. Yeah, it breaks my heart that they didn't continue with Dio and do more stuff. Like, obviously, there was still a working relationship there that they could come back to, you know, mm-hmm. at some point. I mean, there was with Ozzy, but only after, you know, he had done enough drugs to forget about the fights. Then it's like, cool, yeah, let's get back together. But the more and more I'm looking at it, I'm going, you know, Geezer is the one that's setting sort of the aesthetic for everything. He's the one that was into the occult shit and was writing all of that. He's the one, you know, that really was doing the most, I think, innovative stuff in terms of that first album, that Ward as well, Bill Ward as well, you know, really transitioning the jazz and the blues and into something else. And that makes sense. Actually, Geezer leaves and then it's like, yeah. And now the guy that's been the glue, you know, the whole time is gone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. And like, if you look at like Dehumanizer, if you look at the behind the scenes of Dehumanizer, it wasn't like this, like, oh, let's get back with Dio and just make this thing where we're like, they still kind of hated each other and they still kind of, mm-hmm. the way it broke apart was terrible. Apparently Martin has said that like they kept trying to call him back in while they were still like making the album before they started touring it.
I didn't know that.
They were just trying to get Dio out and Dio like, and you know, it ended with the Ozzy reunion and Dio just being like, fuck you guys kind of thing. But then you look at the fucking album, man. And like the power of these guys, like despite themselves.
I mean, it's the thing I talk about with Pink Floyd all the time. It's like, you know, David Gilmour and fucking Roger Waters absolutely despise one another and make four of the most gorgeous fucking albums, you know, Dark Side to the Wall. And it's amazing. And they're like going into the, you know, studio separately and going, Roger wanted that at a 25. Can you turn it down to a 24? Okay, great. You know, like that level of spite. And then
that's Live Evil, right? Like that's the whole the drama behind that. And it just shows that that's the same kind of relationship. I mean, it was great. It's just so powerful, amazing, but there's a power struggle whenever Dio was in the band. And eventually they obviously amazingly iron that out with The Devil, you know, like, I don't know if you guys consider that canon, but I definitely consider it part of the Dio arc.
Absolutely.
It's a different vibe there for sure. But it also, I mean, it was like Dio's deathbed run, you know?
Yep.
Iommi had like cancer halfway through it, and then they restarted it back up again, waited for him. Like, they were a band by that point. They had gone through the shit.
the person that we don't have in the conversation much anymore is Bill Ward. Ward gets the shit end of the stick. And it seems like from a lot of the, well, I learned a lot from Sabbath Bloody Podcast, but also just from other stuff that he, you know, he's the one on Sabotage that's wearing ladies' tights, you know? And it's like, he's just gonna always kind of is a little bit of Ringo to it, you know, yeah. Even though he's fucking brilliant and amazing. I don't think it's like that there's anything with him. He just gets othered a lot by those three guys. Yeah. And I wonder why.
And I think it's because at some point Tony and Ozzy and Geezer all recognize that Black Sabbath was a business. I don't think Bill ever did.
Hmm.
I think Bill always saw this as his three best mates and him hanging out, having a great time, making music, getting blasted, you know, and changing music. I think the rest of them saw contracts and publishing and record deals and can I get a Maserati yet?
Eventually.
And that's not to, you know, denigrate. They're three incredible musicians with three incredible artistic takes. I take nothing away from them. There's nothing wrong with focusing on the business side of the music because it is a business.
They got fucked around so much. You can see it in Geezer. Even now, there's not going to be another Sabbath reunion as much as people say. And I think it's mostly Geezer. I don't think Geezer's like fucking done with it, man. That's why we did the end. We wrote it up and that's what it is.
Right. Ozzy keeps teasing it. Tony keeps teasing it. Yeah. Bill keeps saying, oh, I'd love for it to happen. You never hear a word from Geezer. I think you're 100% correct.
And he's basically gone on record as saying it almost that he's just wants to watch Austin Villa football and pop into things. Like he's showing up all the time. He's still playing bass and who knows, maybe it'll be another GZR album or something pop up, but
great.
I don't think he's not looking for the grand send off reunion thing. And, you're right though. What you're saying about Bill, it is about the first thing I think about him is like, I might've taken the piss out of him because of the back and forth and all the articles when you get into them and you see the backs and forth and you're like, how petty is this? Like, why is he putting this out there? But he wears his heart on his fucking sleeve.
Yeah.
And it's hard because you look at the other three guys and you're like, okay, they're like business, but I understand what they're doing, but why is he like, why would he write a poem a about this?
he does. I read his poetry like on.
Romantic guy, you know, so when he was in that battle, those legal battles, you look at some of the back and forth and like, he'll just come out and be like, yeah, it's with a heavy heart that I tell you guys that, you know, they're not going to give me enough money. And like he just like says it straight out and like, thought it was them versus the world. And, you know,
my buddies every year we'll go down to the NAMM show in California, the National Association of Music Makers. And they're always, you know, come back with, you know, oh, hey, we met this rock star, we met that rock star, which has always felt weird to me. I enjoyed the one time that I went down, but going up to famous people and saying, hey, can I have your autograph? Always feels so fucking phony to me. But they went one year and Bill Ward was an unannounced person. It was the year before I decided to go. And they got Bill's autograph for me and brought it back. And they told me the story that, they got in line, they went up to him and they said, hey, would you be willing to sign an autograph for our friend Ryan? He wasn't able to be here today. And they said that Bill looked up at them with like great big puppy dog eyes and said, is he okay? Like, is everything all right? and like, didn't know me from Adam, didn't know anything about these two, probably talked to 1,000 people in the last 15 minutes and took the opportunity to ask the question, is this guy okay? No, he's cheap and he didn't want to buy a ticket to LA. So I still have that autograph. I still treasure it as it's one of the coolest things. And I love that story because it just shows to me, I love Ozzy. I would never expect Ozzy to ask that question. I would never expect him to do it. You know what I mean? Not because I think he's a jerk, because he just thinks about the business. And I think the fandom may be a little bit differently.
Absolutely. I think that's a really interesting distinction. It's just sort of, it's also group dynamic. You know, there's always the one guy. Everybody for some reason goes like, Well, we got to put this, you know, we got to throw this shaving cream pie in somebody's face. It's Bill. You know, it's got to be fucking Bill.
Okay, I'm gonna take a little break here and enjoy my rat salad. And when we come back, me, my brother Rye, and my other brother Rye are gonna go round the horn with our top four Black Sabbath albums, and you will not believe where Headless Cross ends up on all of our lists. Because it doesn't. When we come back.
Hearing somebody, a tortured vocal like that, and it's talking about, yeah, it's not
actual
just like
torture.
A horror movie. Yeah.
That's the thing. And that's the thing I don't get is like, to me, that death metal shit, it's actually nauseating. Like, it's nauseating. I am like, I have a visceral reaction to it, which I think is supposed to do, but I don't get people who are like, yeah, I love this album about wearing somebody else's skin. It's like, why? That makes me feel like icky. And I don't understand how I'm like, yeah, put on that kid mask.